thank you very much for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for wanting to talk.
I believe I interviewed your husband several years ago.
Yeah, you probably did.
I think it was a novel about Jelly Roll Morton.
Yeah, Jelly Roll Morton's Last Night at the Jungle Inn.
Yeah. But he told me at the time he was either living in Sweden or about to go.
Yeah, actually, we still keep connections to Sweden. We moved there in 1970, and we moved back when I got the job at University of Connecticut. But we go back every year, and we'll probably live there when we're a bit older.
Do you have relatives in Sweden?
No. We're just friends now. Uh-huh. And his record connection ties to Sweden. He was working for years for a company called Sonnet Gramophone. And so he actually started a company here that is linked to that company, his own record company. And so they're sort of partners.
Well, I noticed that he has a new novel out about Elvis Presley.
Yeah, that's coming out. Yes, you are really on top of things.
Well, the publisher sent me a proof.
I see.
And I haven't started to read it yet, but it looks enticing.
Yeah, it's a good little novel.
I just did last year, or maybe a year before, I did something on Elvis Presley with Mark Childress. It was a novel, kind of a fictionalized life of Presley called... I have trouble with titles.
Yeah.
Tender. It was called Tender.
I see.
I don't know if you remember the book or not.
No, I don't.
Not bad. It was...
Uh-huh.
Made up, but then that's what novels are supposed to do.
This one's made up, too, just like Jelly Roll. It's another monologue with Presley talking to his mother on the telephone the whole time. And supposedly after the Ed Sullivan show where he was just shot from the waist up and trying to explain to her what had happened because she was watching it and what was going on in the studio and what's going on in the hotel room. He's in a hotel room with his band after the show. And it finally winds up that... they wish each other good night, and the novel ends. So it's a sweet novel. If you like Jelly Roll, you'll like this one, too.
Well, that's another broadcast.
Yeah.
We're here to talk about you and talk about the Beat Generation and the Portable Beat Reader. I think perhaps we ought to start by defining our terms, and you go into this in quite detail in the introduction to the Beat Reader. Perhaps you can give me a definition for beat.
Well, that word has plagued interviewers since Kerouac really went on the record for having a terrific book with On the Road in 1957. Basically, beat was a term used by a lot of jazz musicians long before the beat writers picked it up after World War II in 1944-45. It means being down and out, being exhausted, being at the bottom, being sort of not beaten in the sense of socially down, but just sort of tired of what's going on the scene. And there were roots that Kerouac insisted went back to beatitude, so that beat was a sort of spiritually illumined state, because one had renounced materialist values and one was going for a brighter, higher illumination. So the Beat Generation were the disaffiliated generation of people who came of age after World War II and were disaffiliated because they didn't want conventional careers. They thought that Mammon, as Ginsberg said in the poem Howl, was the god of America, capitalism, and it was destroying our lives, and were looking for other values.
Then where does the term beatnik derive from?
Well, that was Herb Cain who coined that word in October. Herb Cain coined the word beatnik in April when Sputnik had gone up in 1958, and he was referring to the beats who he put down for the fact that they didn't want to be conventional, and he called them beatniks because they wouldn't go to work and they drank too much wine and they were smoking too much marijuana and just general dropouts, he thought.
So you point out Herb Cain is a newspaper columnist in San Francisco.
Yes, still going strong, I understand.
Now, there are some affiliated definitions with beat, such as hip, right? Hip and hippie.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about these other terms that can, I suppose, be used almost interchangeably.
Yeah, I think you can. Mailer, for example, liked the word hip rather than beat. And there were very fine tunings of the different definition of what the differences were between a beat, who was supposedly hot, and a hipster who was cool in his, you know, behavior. I think that beat really had such derogatory feelings to it in an age in the 1950s that where America was really pretty affluent, that hip sounded a lot friendlier and a lot more exciting. So rather than continue, especially after beatnik sort of was really a derogatory put-down, hip and then hippie came into the 60s. That was the term of choice.
Now, before the Beats, I think the term in vogue was bohemian, wasn't it?
Yes,
they were. So there's sort of a linkage there in some respects, because the bohemians were supposed to be the people also disaffected, somewhat radical, experimental in their poetry and in their literature. So I suppose the Beats were intellectual or artistic heirs of the bohemians.
That's right, they were. With this other overlay, which, as I said, was the beat meaning of, to jazz musicians, somebody who wasn't bohemian, but who was somebody who was poor by sort of choice, being an outsider in society. This is a connection to a social group rather than a literary group, which really confused the issue, you know, even more. But basically, yes, they were the inheritors of the bohemianism, which on the East Coast had really just about died out by the time World War II came around. The Great Depression ended all of that, the experimentation and literary fanfare. And, of course, the Great Depression was another kind of literary movement, a political one. So the Beats really come from both of these strands, experimental writing as well as a kind of avant-garde attitude toward politics as well, changes.
Well, to focus precisely on the beat generation, can we pinpoint who the first beat was?
First beat, I think, really was Herbert Hunke, who was a heroin addict, who was a man who hung out in New York City on Times Square and was the contact for Burroughs, who introduced William Burroughs, the novelist, the would-be novelist, to drugs, and first a morphine and then heroin. And it was Hunke's use of the word beat that, when he said it hunched over a cup of coffee in a Times Square cafeteria, that appealed to Kerouac and made him feel that that word sort of summarized the whole stance of the people who were disaffiliated, didn't want to go with the flow or be conventional, and wanted to find their own vision of what art and life could be like in America.
Now, the Beats began to define themselves directly after the Second World War.
Right, right. And they felt that this John Cullen Holmes is one of the early beat writers in New York, and he felt and has written beautifully about this in his essays that what had happened in Europe during World War II, the concentration camps in America, the discovery and production of the atomic bomb and the use of the atomic bomb really was a terrible end to civilization. And he felt that there should be a new vision of how people should live and how people should create. And this was really the cornerstone of the beat philosophy, that they were going to change everything through insisting that people could find an alternate to society. It was a protest movement.
Now, the Beats as individuals had an affiliation with each other, though, didn't they?
Yes. I mean,
there was not a beat who worked independently of the other beats.
Not really. And there are two coasts going on here. I mean, there's an independent thing happening in California, on the West Coast, during and after, shortly after World War II. They had their own tradition of, shall we say, alternate lifestyles or disaffiliation. And on the East Coast, there's the Ginsberg, Hunke, Burroughs, Kerouac crowd meeting in around Times Square and around Columbia, who were a different group. And it was the meshing of these groups that really gave birth to the Beat Generation in 1956, a public awareness of something going on in literature. But, yeah, in both cases, the group was made up of friends who supported each other and who encouraged each other to be writers and who really shared a lot of beliefs as well as very intense emotional involvements in each other's lives. There were many of them on the East Coast were homosexual, and there was this added sense that they were underground because this wasn't possible to announce publicly in 1948-44. That was part of the sort of cohesion of the movement, too, that they were involved in each other's lives as personal lovers and friends.
It should be noted that with just a couple of exceptions, the Beats were all males.
Yeah, with one wonderful exception, a woman called Diane de Prima, who was Leroy Jones's lover for some of the time she was living in New York, but who really stayed independent, had children with various husbands, but really staunchly went her own way as a poet and as a writer. But for the most part, you're right, it was a male group on both coasts, and women were incidental. They were girlfriends or wives or lovers, and they typed the manuscripts and they brought the coffee, but they didn't really become writers until years later when they wrote memoirs like Joyce Johnson or Hetty Jones. And those memoirs are, I think, part of the Beat statement.
Would it be incorrect to say that perhaps the first definitive piece of literature among the Beats was Howl by Ginsberg?
Yeah, you could say that. Actually, the very first novel published that was Beat was the first novel of William Burroughs called Junk. And it was an Ace paperback published in the early 50s. Whereas in 1956, when City Lights published Howl, that was the first book that really got a lot of attention because it was the subject of an obscenity suit in California, which became a coast-to-coast item publicized by Life magazine, Time, and so forth. But Burroughs didn't really become a writer of any great renown until Naked Lunch, which was the late 50s. Kerouac followed after Howl with On the Road, and that was the second big book. So, yeah, you could say Howl was the first big one, but there had been, as I said, Junk of William Burroughs, and John Cullen Holmes produced a novel called Go in 1953 that was also a Beat book about the same crowd that Kerouac described.
Was it Junk or Junkie?
Started off being Junk, and then he changed it when it became a Penguin recently, about 10 years ago, to Junkie, with a Y. We went through lots of permutations of the title, spelled J-U-N-K, J-U-N-K-I-E, and then now it's J-U-N-K-Y that he prefers.
And he wrote it under a pseudonym, as I recall.
Yes, he was William Lee, which is one of his alter egos in Naked Lunch, too. It's one of his voices.
Burroughs told me that he wished he had kept a couple of copies of that Ace double paperback.
Yeah. Yes.
It would be worth a little money today.
Yes, his books cost a lot, yes, in that especially.
But actually, Burroughs says that his writing came later than many of the others. He, mm-hmm. Although he was an older, rather of a father figure to many of these people, he learned, he said, from Kerouac.
Yes, he's remarkably straight on influences. Of the people's memories do change, and you can always test them against what they're writing in letters to one another or the journals they're keeping. But Burroughs' memory is very accurate, and he does give credit to Kerouac for being the earliest one among the group who was a writer. Kerouac was obsessed with writing. And by the time the group formed in 1944, when Ginsberg and Kerouac met, Kerouac had already written a couple of books. They weren't published, and they still aren't published, the very early ones. But he was really committed to writing and to being a novelist. Whereas I think Allen Ginsberg, of course, thought of being a poet, but it took Kerouac's encouragement to make Ginsberg decide he was going to be a poet. And the same thing was true with Burroughs. Kerouac decided that he and Burroughs could write together, and Burroughs really didn't think of himself as a writer. And they collaborated on a book called The Hippos Were Boiled in Their Tank, which was an imitation of a Dashiell Hammett mystery. They did alternate chapters. This was, I think, around 1948, you know, early, not published either. But it wasn't until later, when Burroughs was living in Mexico City, that he decided to tell the story of his drug addiction by himself without collaboration, and that was his first book.
I wonder about Burroughs. I know he's still publishing books, but I've talked to him a number of times, and he is so laid back,
mm-hmm.
that you wonder if at this point in his life he can intellectualize sufficiently to write a book. I always wondered if someone helped him.
No, he doesn't get help. I don't believe he gets help. He is, as all of the major writers are, really obsessed with writing all the time, or thinking about writing all the time. What made the group really cohere was their belief in writing, and they didn't want to write conventionally. I mean, Ginsberg really was looking for a new vision, and Rimbaud, the French poet, was his guide to that, which meant a lot of drugs and a lot of association, shall we say, with normal routines. And Burroughs at that time, or in the mid-40s, was looking for, as I said, he didn't think of himself as a writer, but he wanted to write in a method called factualism. That was what he was obsessed with. He sort of went 180 degrees from where Ginsberg was going with illuminations. And Kerouac was the old-fashioned one at that time, although they twitted him about it. He loved Thomas Wolfe in the 1930s style, that sort of grand vision of America, the lost vision. So they had to sort of inspire Kerouac, in a sense, to find his own writing soul rather than depend on Thomas Wolfe. And when he wrote his first novel, as a Thomas Wolfe kind of style, The Town and the City, published in 1950, he had sort of written himself out in that style, and he was ready to do something else. And it was, again, that sense in the group that they were all looking for ways to write that were different, that really were individual, and that somehow reflected what they felt about the times being needing change. And so Kerouac, for 7 years, tried to write the book that would become On the Road. And it really wasn't until 1951, in an inspired burst, he discovered his own writing soul at last, he said, and began to write what he called spontaneous prose, or work toward that, which took a while longer to get to. But each of them, the point is, was really not so much a personality as they were writers. And they, all of them, were totally committed to writing in their own voice and finding it, and worked very hard to do that.
Well, Kerouac's spontaneous prose, I think... His reputation did suffer because of that famous Truman Capote comment, that's not writing, that's typing.
Yes, it was too bad.
That's hard to live down.
You know what was the pity? I just recently saw the manuscript of On the Road, the original roll of a 120-foot roll that was the first draft, you might say, of the book that was published as On the Road.
Yeah, he used teletype paper, didn't he?
No, he used, believe it or not, almost translucent drafting paper, the kind that you trace over. The person who had been in the rooms that he rented the apartment before him had left 10-foot sheets of this paper around, and Kerouac hit on the idea of taking a scissors, because it was 1 foot, wide and 10 feet long, and it wouldn't fit into the typewriter roller. So he cut off a half an inch on the left margin, looks like with the nail scissors, so that he could roll it into the typewriter. And he started typing on this sheet of paper. And when he got to the end of it, he took some scotch tape and taped on another roll. So he did 10 sheets like that, 120 feet of a novel, which I saw recently. And, Capote was right. It was typing in the sense that it was a flow. But what is so extraordinary about it is that there were very few strikeovers. There were very few times where he decided he wasn't satisfied with the line and therefore wanted to repeat it. And from what I saw, I didn't see the whole thing because it's a little fragile now and I didn't want to unwind it. But it looked like, from the first 10 feet anyway, it was almost word for word the published version. And this is first draft, okay? So we're talking inspiration here. We're talking somebody who was really typing, sure, but typing, from a place that was a very inspired place indeed. I don't think Capote could have typed first draft, the first 10 feet of any book he ever wrote.
No, Capote was one of these methodical miniaturists in some respects. Everything he wrote was really small, tiny, that he labored over. Mm-hmm. No, his stuff wouldn't flow like Kerouac's. Mm-hmm. Now, what about these books that Burroughs wrote with Brian Geisen, that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah.
Where they would take scissors and cut out sections and rearrange them arbitrarily?
Well, this is a Dada discovery. It really wasn't a discovery that Burroughs made. This was in Paris after he finished Naked Lunch, and he was living in what was called the Beat Hotel in Paris. He and Geisen sort of started to do experiments, and they really were, I think, inspired by being in France, my sense of it is. And that led them, I think, along the lines of, well, let's really go farther out than we have before with what we were doing, and let's break all the rules, which means the word itself is taken as a sign rather than in itself, rather than as a unit in a sentence which, quote, makes sense, which has cohesive ability. So they began to play around with with words and in, of course, always altered states. They were always taking one or another kind of either hallucinogen or, you know, narcotic of whatever means. And this made more sense, I think, under those circumstances as experiments. Now there's another kind of put down of Paul Bowles, who, like Truman Capote, was very obsessive. And he said that this wasn't writing, Burroughs' cut-up method. This was plumbing. So the beats have always attracted. Because, you see, they always went farther out than anyone else at the time wanted. They were the liveliest literary movement, experimental movement, I think, post-war in this country. And so they would try things that, with their writing and with their lives, that maybe did go a bit far. And in some respect, they were destructive. I'm thinking of Neil Cassady, for example, who went too far out, as far as I could tell. And the Beats were willing to do this. And, you know, Carolyn Cassady can write about her life with Neil and Jack as going farther out in terms of conventional marriages, sharing partners. But they were more open about it. They believed, as Ginsberg said, that private is public. So everything they wrote became gist for their writing, autobiographical fiction. And they were just always farther than anyone, you know, who was sane truly wanted to go.
Now, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, you have put him with the Beats. And when I was a young man, his Coney Island of the Mind was a very influential book to me, and I'd always associated him with the Beats, too. But I've interviewed Ferlinghetti, and he insists he is not one of the Beats.
Mm-hmm.
That, in fact, while the during the highlight of the Beat generation, he was actually studying at the Sorbonne in Paris.
Well.
And that he became associated with them because of the City Lights books and his bookshop there. But he always insisted he was never himself a Beat.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. He was at the Sorbonne in the 40s, after the war, when all of this thing was starting to cook in New York. But when he moved to San Francisco and opened his bookstore in 53, City Lights, the first paperback store in America, he had decided to publish these little books of poetry in the Pocket Poet series. And when he went to the poetry reading, he was not included as a Beat poet, although the word Beat poet really wasn't in use in 1955 when the Six Gallery reading was organized. That's where Ginsberg read Howell for the first time in public. But Ferlinghetti was in the audience then, and he loved the poem, and he asked Ginsberg to let him publish it as a Pocket Poet's poem. Ginsberg agreed to that. And so, really, although Ferlinghetti might, you know, technically say that as a writer, he's out of it, a literary movement is made up of its publishers and its supporters. And without City Lights on the West Coast, there would, of course, been Grove Press and New Directions in New York, but City Lights was the company that went out to the edge to really support that gang of writers. And without his sending checks to Ginsberg and, you know, agreeing that Corso was a great poet and so forth, the movement would have had a lot less movement to it. So I think he's a lot of things, Ferlinghetti. Number one, he's a terrifically successful businessman. And he can absolutely paint up a storm, as you know. He's been a painter for the last 40 years as well.
Well, being a businessman alone sets him apart from the Beats.
Doesn't it? Doesn't it, though? He's an honest businessman also. I mean, I can trace the history of the publishing company, City Lights, and you can absolutely see his responses to their calls for money from all the four ends of the earth, you know. And he's absolutely, they're thanking him in their letters for what he's sending them. So he was really there for them. And at the same time, he never went overboard. I mean, he knows what City Lights can do as a publishing company, so he doesn't accept large manuscripts. He didn't, for example, publish the full book of Kerouac's Book of Dreams because he knew he couldn't afford to. He cuts it real fine. I wanted Ferlinghetti to publish The Beat Reader. That he was my first choice, obviously, because of his involvement with the Beats. How's that? But a book of 650 pages was too big for Ferlinghetti. And my second choice, of course, was the Portable series, the Viking Portable series, because they had educated me when I was growing up. And I was honored that they accepted the anthology. But it would have been City Lights first, and then because of its support of these marvelous writers.
Now, some of the beats have become almost establishment. Gary Snyder has won a Pulitzer Prize, so has Ginsberg. Mm-hmm. So in some respects, over the years, as they've matured, they've moved almost into the mainstream, haven't they?
Yeah, they definitely have. This word beat has really mostly had, I like to use the past tense, negative connotations, beat, meaning outlaws or a protest movement. And when Snyder won the Pulitzer, he really wanted to drop the label beat and call himself, why don't you call me a Pulitzer Prize winning poet rather than a beat poet, he asks. And they were glad to see it go because it had the negative connotations and it didn't stress the writing as much as it stressed the lifestyle, the beat lifestyle or the beatnik lifestyle after Herb Cain had sort of made that connection. And the people who were involved as writers, like Burroughs or Snyder or Ferlinghetti or Ginsberg, were really intent, of course, on their own careers. And they developed as artists and have published many books. So they didn't need to belong to a movement. A successful movement always ends as the individuals who are the best part of it go on to their own, you know, definition of their own work. And the wonderful thing about the beat movement was that it really had no boundaries. You could join it if you were a woman or if you were black or you were a Jew or you were a Catholic. It had no prescription about how to write. You could write as Kerouac did, using Thomas Wolfe as a model, as long as you understood what you were doing and went on to something else. Experimental writing was really what, and free-form poetry were really what they were interested in aesthetically. But again, no narrow platform. And again, geographically, they weren't all living in, you know, Concord around the, you know, Thoreau's Lake. They could be anywhere in America, or they could be in Tangier. In fact, there are a lot of poets calling themselves beat poets who are in England or even in Sweden. You have people who affiliate themselves with the beats. Fine. It's totally open.
Well, you have some references to Ken Kesey. Is he considered a beat?
Well, there's a generation after the beats that I was sort of plagued with putting the book together. Okay, when I put it together, I wanted a couple of things. I wanted there to be a very clear definition, as clear as possible, about what this very amorphous literary movement had been, because everybody agreed there was a beat movement, even if it was hard to pin it down. And so to make it as clear as possible, I tried to stay with the people who were there at the very beginning, or the people who had close affiliations to the writers who were there at the beginning. And so Kesey is in there as a person who wrote about the death of Neil Cassady. There's a story of Kesey's there. But I don't have an excerpt from, say, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which you could stretch to be a beat book, even though it comes a little late in the heyday of the movement. So I sort of fudge with Kesey, and I fudge with Charles Bukowski, who's also there. And he's not strictly a beat writer. I don't think any more than Ferlinghetti he'd like to be called a beat writer. And yet he wrote so well about and was so sympathetic to the beats in his sketch of the last meeting with Neil Cassady that I felt he should go in. In the headnotes to the volume, I try to specify as clearly as possible who is part of that original group and what the relationship of the others are to the original group. But I've run through some criticism, as was inevitable, since I couldn't make the book any bigger than 650 pages. I had to be careful about the selection. And, for example, I have William Everson and Kenneth Rexroth, but why not Robert Duncan, you know, another San Francisco Renaissance poet? Or Robert Creeley, even more closely related, you know, a Black Mountain, quote, poet from the 50s. So, you know, I was...
Now, Creeley has always insisted he is part of that other Black Mountain movement.
Yes, he is.
Poets and,
but Ginsberg said, why don't you have Creeley in there? You know,
yeah,
Creeley
but he
should
seems
be in
like
there
a beat poet to me.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of similar... He's very sympathetic to it. But because he says no, and he's never published, as Ferlinghetti has, or been there in court when Ginsberg needed someone to stand up and defend him, as Ferlinghetti did, there is just not enough room to put the Bob Creeley, and then I would have to, of course, include Olson, and why not Sid Corman? And there were a lot of bohemian poets in America in the 1950s. But I'm trying to really specify a group at the center who had a very specific program and a very specific stance, and aesthetic and political.
Now, how accurate is my perception that the beats seem to be self-destructive, personally self-destructive?
Well, all I can say is that we still have on the planet Herbert Hunke, William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg,
right.
And
Gary Snyder.
Well, no one, I think, really ever thought Snyder, whose stamina and being able to sit in Zen monastery strikes me as almost athletic. But we do have, in other words, Kesey, if you want to count Kesey in, too. There have been a lot of people who, as you say, perhaps involve themselves in self-destructive, certainly illegal activities, and they didn't kill themselves. They only killed themselves, like Kerouac, if they were intent upon doing it. And Kerouac did it with alcohol, which is very legal and happens all the time.
How did you develop this fascination for the beat writers?
Well, I first saw them in Berkeley when I was an undergraduate, at a poetry reading, which was in 1956, a repeat of that Six Gallery reading in San Francisco. I didn't go to that in October 55, but I was there in Berkeley to see Ginsberg again read Howell and all of the same people who were there, Snyder and Rex Roth and so forth. And my date for this poetry reading was Peter Orlovsky, who was Ginsberg's lover, unknown to me, but had decided with Ginsberg that he needed to try dating girls. And my roommate at the co-op, Ritter Hall, where I was living as a junior at Berkeley, thought I needed a new date. So she fixed me up with Peter. And he didn't have a car, but we walked down to Allen's cottage on Milvia. And then I drove with a gang of poets to this theater where I saw Robert Levine's sketches of Peter and Allen making love on the walls. And the sketches were on the walls. And I was very surprised. I was 19, and from a pretty square family in Los Angeles. But I was astonished at the poetry, which was the reading that followed. And I didn't agree with Peter, who walked me back all the way up Dwight Way to my co-op after the reading. I didn't agree that Ginsberg would be as well known as Walt Whitman. I thought that was a terribly impious comparison, which Peter wanted to make, that Howell was as important as Leaves of Grass. But I was impressed, and I've never forgotten what the excitement of that poetry reading. But then I didn't really get involved again until 1966, which is when I finished my doctorate at Columbia. And I'd been reading Kerouac and collecting him. I liked his work a lot. And the Phoenix Bookstore was doing a bibliography series of avant-garde writers, and they asked me to compile the Kerouac bibliography for them. So I wrote Kerouac in Hyannis, where he was living with his mother, and he invited me to his home. So I spent 2 days with Kerouac in the summer of 1966, compiling his bibliography. And that was the beginning, and I sort of went on from there.
Well, the loss of the Phoenix, that was really a terrible loss. Robert Wilson's collection of the Beat Generation literature, well, there's nothing else to duplicate it.
No, there's no store like Bob Wilson's store. That's over. That's too bad. It's funny. I still think about it a lot because I got a lot of the books that are in my collection from Bob. And, yeah, I miss him a lot. We still correspond about Gertrude Stein, who is his first and greatest.
What's Wilson doing these days?
Wilson lives in Maryland. He's retired. I think he's in good health, and he has been updating his bibliography of Gertrude Stein. We've been in contact for that. I did an introduction to Three Lives when it was part of this Penguin American Classic series, which Bob didn't know about, so I sent it to him, and he sent me a gracious note, that sort of thing, you know. So he's pretty good.
I have his book on collecting rare books, and I noticed he has his own personal selection of the great books this century, and predominantly, they are the Beat writers.
Right. Yes, he was a very early supporter. His bibliography was McClure. His series was McClure and Corso, as well as Kerouac and some others. And he was always there for them also. He was someone who supported a little magazine, which I think was the most important Beat magazine on the East Coast, which was called Floating Bear, Diane DePrima and Leroy Jones, on a mimeograph machine. Circulated this for a long, long time, about 5 years probably. And when it was new, Bob Wilson at the Phoenix would let's say he gave them money for, they had this little trade. He would always take 50 copies. And so he'd give them the money in advance so that they could buy the paper. And then they could use his machine as well. And then, of course, when the thing started to go a little bigger, they didn't have to rely on him like that. But without Robert Wilson, there wouldn't have been the floating bear.
Hmm. Well, I certainly look forward to getting his catalogs every couple of months. And I think I was in his shop about at least once a month.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a lot of stuff from him. So it was very painful to see that store close up.
It was a beautiful store, too.
Yeah, nice location. Mm-hmm. I just loved it.
Yeah.
Well, Ann Charters, to kind of wrap things up, give me, of course, you have a vested interest in the Beat writers, so I have a feeling I know how you're going to answer this question. But in terms of their staying power as literature, in much literature, there is an academic thrust. It's like, if I can phrase this correctly, I probably should have written this out. In classical music, the great composers wrote very specifically and precisely, and their work can be performed today because everything is written in such a precise manner. The Beats strike me more as improvisational jazz performers, and you wonder, in the future, say in the next century, will people be reading the Beats? Will they be following these improvisational writers the way the academic writers will continue to be read? People like Hawthorne and Chekhov and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know your question.
Didn't phrase that very well.
Yeah, it's a good. I think I follow your drift. I mean, improvisational poetry is now big again. There was a big article on it in the Times, for example, and it goes on. There are like 16 clubs in the five boroughs of Manhattan where young people stand up and read poetry, their own poetry. Those people are not interested in reading aloud the poetry, say, that was improvisational of, say, Bob Kaufman. Who? What? What's that name again, you say? Bob Kaufman was an improvisational poet who was in San Francisco and read to jazz. His poetry was, it's impossible to capture it on the page. And so if you are thinking about future generations of reading, it's very unlikely, I think, that anyone will continue to read Bob Kaufman except as part of a larger group. But the writers like Ginsberg, Kerouac, Burroughs, Ferlinghetti, Snyder, writers who believed in the improvisational and believed in public performance and the word which was spread through reading rather than on the page, also were artists who spent an awful lot of time getting it right on the page and revising, despite what Truman Capote said about Kerouac and despite Burroughs' sense of experimentation being an end in itself. They also wrote books that are filled with content, and the content really reflects central issues in the history of our country, as well as in what we all go through as human beings. And the sense that Kerouac has, for example, in the promise of America, and the sense of the open spaces of America, and that incredible helter-skelter going back and forth with Dean Moriarty, Sal Paradise at the, you know, in these cars, that is a sense of the cowboy crashing, as Gary Snyder said. That's one of the American myths that is captured in On the Road, the search for something at the end of the road, which they never quite come to find. And Ginsberg's Kaddish, which is all about his mother's political involvement and her breakdowns and its effect on the family, is one of the most startling and strong poems, I think, of American poetry in the last 50 years. And I think it's going to be here a long, long time. So I think just on those two writers alone, people are going to be reading Beat writing.
So you're saying the Beats have a future.
I definitely do. I wanted the idea of a movement to have a future, too, the sense of a community of writers. In a way, this is a how-to-do-it book. I dedicated it to my daughters, who are teenagers and older and don't really read the Beats that much. But I wanted them to see how it had happened. I didn't want it to be all scattered and lost. Because what the Beats did as a group, as a community of people who supported one another emotionally and encouraged each other to write This, I thought, was a very, very important thing to say in a time in America where things are splintered and the center may not hold.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and it belongs on the shelf of everyone who wants to know something about that period in our literature. Portable Beat Reader, it's terrific. Thank you very much, Ann Charters.
Thank you very much.